This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Knicks by Nathan Hill. Read for you by Ari Fliakos. There was a king in Savatthi who addressed a man and asked him to round up all the persons in the city who were blind from birth. When the man had done so, the king asked the man to show the blind man an elephant. To some of the blind men he presented the head of the elephant, to some the ear, to others a tusk, the trunk, the body, a foot, the hindquarters, the tail, or the tuft at the end of the tail. And to each one he said, "This is an elephant." When he reported to the king what he had done, the king went to the blind men and asked them, "Tell me, blind men, what is an elephant like?" Those who had been shown the head of the elephant replied, "An elephant, your majesty, is just like a water jar." Those who had been shown the ear replied, "An elephant is just like a winnowing basket." Those who had been shown the tusk replied, "An elephant is just like a plowshare." Those who had been shown the trunk replied, "An elephant is just like a plow pole." Those who had been shown the body replied, "An elephant is just like a storeroom." And each of the others likewise described the elephant in terms of the part they had been shown. Then saying, "An elephant is like this, an elephant is not like that, an elephant is not like this, an elephant is like that," they fought each other with their fists, and the king was delighted. Inspired Utterances of the Buddha. Prologue. Late Summer 1988. If Samuel had known his mother was leaving, he might have paid more attention. He might have listened more carefully to her, observed her more closely, written certain crucial things down. Maybe he could have acted differently, spoken differently, been a different person. Maybe he could have been a child worth sticking around for. But Samuel did not know his mother was leaving. He did not know she had been leaving for many months now, in secret and in pieces. She had been removing items from the house one by one. A single dress from her closet, then a lone photo from the album, a fork from the silverware drawer, a quilt from under the bed. Every week, she took something new. A sweater, a pair of shoes, a Christmas ornament, a book. Slowly, her presence in the house grew thinner. She'd been at it almost a year when Samuel and his father began to sense something, a sort of instability, a puzzling and disturbing and sometimes even sinister feeling of depletion. It struck them at odd moments. They looked at the bookshelf and thought, "Don't we own more books than that?" They walked by the china cabinet and felt sure something was missing. But what? They could not give it a name, this impression that life's details were being reorganized. They didn't understand that the reason they were no longer eating crockpot meals was that the crockpot was no longer in the house. If the bookshelf seemed bare, it was because she had pruned it of its poetry. If the china cabinet seemed a little vacant, it was because two plates, two bowls, and a teapot had been lifted from the collection. They were being burglarized at a very slow pace. "Didn't there used to be more photos on that wall?" Samuel's father said, standing at the foot of the stairs, squinting. "Didn't we have that picture from the Grand Canyon up there?"
"No," Samuel's mother said. "We put that picture away."
We did? I don't remember that.
It was your decision.
It was? He said, befuddled. He thought he was losing his mind. Years later, in a high school biology class, Samuel heard a story about a certain kind of African turtle that swam across the ocean to lay its eggs in South America. Scientists could find no reason for the enormous trip. Why did the turtles do it? The leading theory was that they began doing it eons ago, when South America and Africa were still locked together. Back then, only a river might have separated the continents, and the turtles laid their eggs on the river's far bank. But then the continents began drifting apart, and the river widened by about an inch per year, which would have been invisible to the turtles, so they kept going to the same spot, the far bank of the river, each generation swimming a tiny bit farther than the last one. And after 100 million years of this, the river had become an ocean, and yet the turtles never noticed. This, Samuel decided, was the manner of his mother's departure. This was how she moved away. Imperceptibly, slowly, bit by bit. She whittled down her life until the only thing left to remove was herself. On the day she disappeared, she left the house with a single suitcase. Part 1. The Packer Attacker. Late Summer 2011. 1. The headline appears one afternoon on several news websites almost simultaneously. Governor Packer attacked. Television picks it up moments later, bumping into programming for a breaking news alert as the anchor looks gravely into the camera and says, "We're hearing from our correspondents in Chicago that Governor Sheldon Packer has been attacked." And that's all anyone knows for a while, that he was attacked. And for a few dizzying minutes, everyone has the same two questions. Is he dead? And is there video? The first word comes from reporters on the scene who call in with cell phones and are put on the air live. They say Packer was at the Chicago Hilton hosting a dinner and speech. Afterward, he was making his way with his entourage through Grant Park, glad-handing, baby-kissing, doing all your typical populist campaign maneuvers, when suddenly, from out of the crowd, a person or a group of people began to attack. "What do you mean, attack?" the anchor asks. He sits in a studio with shiny black floors and a lighting scheme of red, white, and blue. His face is smooth as cake fondant. Behind him, people at desks seem to be working. He says, "Could you describe the attack?" "All I actually know right now," the reporter says, "is that things were thrown."
"What things?"
"That is unclear at this time."
"Was the governor struck by any of the things? Is he injured?"
"I believe he was struck, yes."
"Did you see the attackers? Were there many of them?"
"Throwing the things." "There was a lot of confusion and some yelling."
"The things that were thrown, were they big things or small things?"
"I guess I would say small enough to be thrown."
"Were they larger than baseballs, the thrown things?"
"No, smaller."
"So golf ball-sized things?"
"Maybe that's accurate."
"Were they sharp? Were they heavy?"
"It all happened very fast."
"Was it premeditated or a conspiracy?"
"There are many questions of that sort being asked." A logo is made. Terror in Chicago. It whooshes to a spot next to the anchor's ear and flaps like a flag in the wind. The news displays a map of Grant Park on a massive touchscreen television in what has become a commonplace of modern newscasting. Someone on television communicating via another television, standing in front of the television and controlling the screen by pinching it with his hands and zooming in and out in super high definition. It all looks really cool. While they wait for new information to surface, they debate whether this incident will help or hurt the governor's presidential chances. Help, they decide, as his name recognition is pretty low outside of a rabid conservative evangelical following, who just loves what he did during his tenure as governor of Wyoming, where he banned abortion outright and required the Ten Commandments to be publicly spoken by children and teachers every morning before the Pledge of Allegiance, and made English the official and only legal language of Wyoming, and banned anyone not fluent in English from owning property. Also, he permitted firearms in every state wildlife refuge, and he issued an executive order requiring state law to supersede federal law in all matters, a move that amounted to, according to constitutional scholars, a fiat secession of Wyoming from the United States. He wore cowboy boots. He held press conferences at his cattle ranch. He carried an actual, live, real gun, a revolver that dangled in a leather holster at his hip. At the end of his one term as governor, he declared he was not running for re-election in order to focus on national priorities, and the media naturally took this to mean he was running for president. He perfected a sort of preacher-slash-cowboy pathos and an anti-elitist populism and found a receptive audience, especially among blue-collar white conservatives put out by the current recession. He compared immigrants taking American jobs to coyotes killing livestock. And when he did this, he pronounced coyotes pointedly with two syllables, coyotes. He put an R sound in Washington so it became Washington. He said bushed instead of tired. He said yallow for yellow and creek for creek. Supporters said that's just how normal, non-elite people from Wyoming talked. His detractors loved pointing out that since the courts had struck down almost all of his Wyoming initiatives, his legislative record was effectively nil. None of that seemed to matter to the people who continued to pay for his $500 plate fundraisers, which, by the way, he called grubdowns, and his $10,000 lecture fees and his $30 hardcover book, The Heart of a True American, loading up his war chest, as the reporters like to call it, for a future presidential run, maybe. And now the governor has been attacked, though nobody seems to know how he's been attacked, what he's been attacked with, who he's been attacked by, or if the attack has injured him. News anchors speculate at the potential damage of taking a ball bearing or a marble at high velocity right in the eye. They talk about this for a good 10 minutes, with charts showing how a small mass traveling at close to 60 miles per hour could penetrate the eye's liquid membrane. When this topic wears itself out, they break for commercials. They promote their upcoming documentary on the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, Day of Terror, Decade of War. They wait. Then something happens to save the news from the state of idleness into which it has drifted. The anchor reappears and announces that a bystander caught the whole spectacular thing on video and has now posted it online. And so here is the video that's going to be shown several thousand times on television over the next week that will collect millions of hits and become the third most watched internet clip this month behind the new music video from teen pop singing sensation Molly Miller, for her single, You Have Got to Represent, and a family video of a toddler laughing until he falls over. Here is what happens. The video begins in whiteness and wind, the sound of wind blowing over an exposed microphone, then fingers fumbling over and pressing into the mic to create seashell-like swooshing sounds as the camera adjusts its aperture to the bright day and the whiteness resolves to a blue sky, indistinct, unfocused greenishness that is presumably grass, and then a voice, a man's voice, loud and too close to the mic.
Is it on? I don't know if it's on.
The picture comes into focus just as the man points the camera at his own feet. He says in an annoyed and exasperated way, Is this even on? How can you tell? And then a woman's voice, calmer, melodious, peaceful, says,
You look at the back. What does it say on the back?
And her husband or boyfriend or whoever he is who cannot manage to keep the picture steady says,
Would you just help me?
In this aggressive and accusatory way that's meant to communicate that whatever problem he's having with the camera is her responsibility. The video through all this is a jumpy, dizzying close-up of the man's shoes, puffy white high tops. Extraordinarily white and new-looking, he seems to be standing on top of a picnic table.
What does it say on the back? The woman asks.
Where? What back?
On the screen.
I know that, he says. Where on the screen?
In the bottom right corner, she says, with perfect equanimity. What does it say?
It says R.
That means it's recording. It's on.
That's stupid, he says. Why doesn't it say on?
The picture bobs between his shoes and what seems to be a crowd of people in the middle distance.
There he is! Look it! That's him! There he is!
The man shouts. He points the camera forward, and when he finally manages to keep it from trembling, Sheldon Packer comes into view, about 30 yards away and surrounded by campaign staffers and security. There is a light crowd, people in the foreground becoming suddenly aware that something's happening, that someone famous is nearby. The cameraman is now yelling, Governor! 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 Governor!
Governor! Governor!
The picture begins shaking again, presumably from this guy waving or jumping or both.
How do you make this thing zoom? He says.
You press zoom, says the woman.
Then the picture begins to zoom, which causes even more focus and exposure-related problems. In fact, the only reason any of this footage is at all usable on television is because the man eventually hands the camera to his partner, saying,
Here, would you just take this?
He rushes over to shake the governor's hand. Later, all of this blather will be edited out, so the clip that will be repeated hundreds of times on television will begin here, paused, as the news puts a small red circle around a woman sitting on a park bench on the right side of the screen.
This appears to be the perpetrator, the anchor says.
She's white-haired, probably 60, sitting there reading a book, in no way unusual, like an extra in a movie, filling out the frame. She's wearing a light blue shirt over a tank top, black leggings that look elastic and yoga-inspired. Her short hair is tousled and falls in little spikes over her forehead. She seems to have an athletic compactness to her, thin, but also muscular. She notices what's happening around her. She sees the governor approaching and closes her book and stands and watches. She's on the edge of the frame, seemingly trying to decide what to do. Her hands are on her hips. She's biting the inside of her mouth. It looks like she's weighing her options. The question this pose seems to ask is, should I? Then she starts walking, quickly, toward the governor. She has discarded her book on the bench and she's walking, taking these large strides like suburbanites doing laps around the mall. Except her arms stay steady at her sides, her fists in balls. She gets close enough to the governor that she's within throwing range, and at that moment, fortuitously, the crowd parts, so from the vantage point of our videographer, there's a clear line of sight from this woman to the governor. The woman stands on a gravel path and looks down and bends at her knees and scoops up a handful of rocks. Thus armed, she yells, and this is very clear as the wind dies down exactly at this moment and the crowd seems to hush. Almost as if everyone knows this event is going to happen, and so they all do what they can to successfully capture it. She yells, "You pig!" And then she throws the rocks. At first there's just confusion as people turn to see where the yelling is coming from, or they wince and flinch away as they are struck by the stones. And then the woman scoops another handful of rocks and throws and scoops and throws and scoops and throws like a child in an all-out snowball war. The small crowd ducks for cover and mothers protect their children's faces and the governor doubles over, his hand covering his right eye. And the woman keeps throwing rocks until the governor's security guards reach her and tackle her. Or not really tackle, but rather embrace her and slump to the ground like exhausted wrestlers. And that's it. The whole video lasts less than a minute. After the broadcast, certain facts become available in short order. The woman's name is released. Faye Anderson Anderson, which everyone on the news mistakenly pronounces as Anderson Anderson, making parallels to other infamous double names, notably Sirhan Sirhan. It is quickly discovered that she is a teaching assistant at a local elementary school, which gives ammunition to certain pundits who say it shows how the radical liberal agenda has taken over public education. The headline is updated to "Teacher Attacks Governor Packer" for about an hour until someone manages to find an image that allegedly shows the woman attending a protest in 1968. In the photo, she sits in a field with thousands of others, a great indistinct mass of people, many of them holding homemade banners or signs, one of them waving high an American flag. The woman looks at the photographer drowsily from behind her big, round eyeglasses. She leans to her right like she might be resting against someone who's barely out of frame. All that's visible is a shoulder. To her left, a woman with long hair and an army jacket stares menacingly at the camera over silver aviator shades. The headline changes to, "60s Radical Attacks Governor Packer." And as if the story isn't delicious enough already, two things happen near the end of the workday to vault it into the stratosphere, water cooler-wise. First, it's reported that Governor Packer is having emergency surgery on his eyeball. And second, a mug shot is unearthed that shows the woman was arrested in 1968, though never officially charged or convicted, for prostitution. This is just too much. How can one headline possibly gather all these amazing details?
Radical hippie prostitute teacher blinds Governor Packer in vicious attack.
The news plays over and over the part of the video where the governor is struck. They enlarge it so it's all pixelated and grainy in a valiant effort to show everyone the exact moment that a sharp piece of gravel splashes into his right cornea. Pundits argue about the meaning of the attack and whether it represents a threat to democracy. Some call the woman a terrorist. Others say it shows how far our political discourse has fallen. Others say the governor pretty much asked for it by being such a reckless crusader for guns. Comparisons are made with the Weather Underground and the Black Panthers. The NRA releases a statement saying the attack never would have happened had Governor Packer been carrying his revolver. The people working at their desks behind the TV anchor, meanwhile, do not appear at this moment to be working any harder or less hard than they were earlier in the day. It takes about 45 minutes for a clever copywriter to come up with the phrase Packer Attacker, which is promptly adopted by all the networks and incorporated into the special logos they make for the coverage. The woman herself is being kept in a downtown jail awaiting arraignment and is unavailable for comment. Without her explanation, the narrative of the day forms when opinion and assumption combine with a few facts to create an earth story that hardens in people's minds. The woman is a former hippie and current liberal radical who hates the governor so much that she waited in a premeditated way to viciously attack him. Except there's a glaring logical hole in this theory, which is that the governor's jaunt through the park was an impromptu move that not even his security detail knew about. Thus, the woman couldn't have known he was coming, and so couldn't have been waiting in ambush. However, this inconsistency is lost in the more sensational news items, and is never fully investigated.
2. Professor Samuel Anderson sits in the darkness of his small university office, his face lit grayly by the glow of a computer screen. Blinds are drawn over the windows. A towel blocks the crack under the door. He has placed the trash bin out in the hall so the night janitor won't interrupt. He wears headphones so nobody will hear what he's doing. He logs on. He reaches the game's intro screen with its familiar image of orcs and elves torqued in battle. He hears the brass heavy music, triumphant and bold and warlike. He types a password even more involved and intricate than the password to his bank account. And as he enters the world of Elfscape, he enters not as Samuel Anderson, the assistant professor of English, but rather as Dodger, the elven thief. And the feeling he has is very much like the feeling of coming home. Coming home at the end of a long day to someone who's glad you're back is the feeling that keeps him logging on and playing upward of 40 hours a week in preparation for a raid like this. When he gathers with his anonymous online friends, and together they go kill something big and deadly. Tonight, it's a dragon. They log on from basements, offices, dimly lit dens, cubicles, and workstations, from public libraries, dorm rooms, spare bedrooms, from laptops on kitchen tables, from computers that whir hotly and click and crackle like somewhere inside their plastic towers a food item is frying. They put on their headsets and log on and materialize in the game world, and they are together again, just as they have been every Wednesday and Friday and Saturday night for the past few years. Almost all of them live in Chicago or very close to Chicago. The game server on which they're playing, one of thousands worldwide, is located in a former meatpacking warehouse on Chicago's south side, and for lag and latency-related issues, Elfscape always places you in the server nearest your location. So they are all practically neighbors, though they have never met in real life.
"Yo, Dodger,"
someone says as Samuel logs in. "Yo," he writes back. He never talks here. They think he doesn't talk because he doesn't have a microphone. The truth is he does have a microphone, but he's worried that if he talks during these raids, some wandering colleague out in the hall might hear him saying things about dragons. So the guild knows really nothing about him except that he never misses a raid and has the tendency to spell out words rather than use the accepted internet abbreviations. He will actually write "be right back" instead of the more common BRB. He will write "away from keyboard" rather than AFK. People are not sure why he insists on this reverse anachronism,
They think the name Dodger has something to do with baseball, but in fact it is a Dickens reference. That nobody gets the reference makes Samuel feel smart and superior, which is something he needs to feel to offset the shame of spending so much time playing a game also played by 12-year-olds. Samuel tries to remind himself that millions of other people do this, on every continent, 24 hours a day. At any given moment, the number of people playing World of Elfscape is a population about the size of Paris, he thinks, sometimes when he feels that rip inside him because this is where his life has ended up. One reason he never tells anybody in the real world that he plays Elfscape is that they might ask what the point of the game is, and what could he say? To slay dragons and kill orcs. Or you can play the game as an orc, in which case the point is to slay dragons and kill elves. But that's it. That's the tableau, the fundamental premise, this basic yin and yang. He began as a level 1 elf and worked his way up to a level 90 elf, and this took roughly 10 months. Along the way, he had adventures. He traveled continents. He met people. He found treasure. He completed quests. Then, at level 90, he found a guild and teamed up with his new guildmates to kill dragons and demons, and most especially orcs. He's killed so many orcs. And when he stabs an orc in one of the vital places, in the neck or head or heart, the game flashes critical hit, and there's a little noise that goes off, a little orcish cry of terror. He's come to love that noise. He drools over that noise. His character class is Thief, which means his special abilities include pickpocketing and bomb-making and invisibility. And one of his favorite things is to sneak into orc-heavy territory and plant dynamite on the road for orcs to ride over and get killed by. Then he loots the bodies of his enemies and collects their weapons and money and clothes and leaves them naked and defeated and dead. Why this has become so compelling, he isn't really sure. Tonight it's 20 elves armed and armored against this one dragon because it is a very large dragon with razor-sharp teeth. Plus it breathes fire. Plus it's covered in scales the thickness of sheet metal, which is something they can see if their graphics card is good enough. The dragon appears to be asleep. It is curled, cat-like on the floor of its magma-rich lair, which is set inside a hollowed-out volcano, naturally. The ceiling of the lair is high enough to allow for sustained dragon flight because during the battle's second phase, the dragon will launch into the air and circle them from above and shoot fiery bombs onto their heads. This will be the fourth time they've tried to kill this dragon. They have never made it past phase two. They want to kill it because the dragon guards a heap of treasure and weapons and armor at the far end of the lair, the looting of which will be sweet vis-a-vis their war against the orcs. Veins of bright red magma glow just under the ground's rocky surface. They will break open during the third and final phase of the fight, a phase they have not yet seen because they just cannot get the hang of the fireball dodging thing.
"Did you all watch the videos I sent?"
asks their raid leader, an elf warrior named Ponage. Several players' avatars nod their heads. He had emailed them tutorials showing how to defeat this dragon. What Ponage wanted them to pay attention to was how to manage Phase 2, the secret to which seems to be keep moving and avoid getting bunched up.
"Let's go,"
writes Axeman, whose avatar is currently dry-humping a rock wall. Several elves dance in place while Ponage explains the fight to them again. Samuel plays Elfscape from his office computer because of the faster internet connection, which can increase his damage output in a raid like this by up to 2%, usually. Unless there's some bandwidth traffic problems, like when students are registering for classes. He teaches literature at a small university northwest of Chicago, in a suburb where all the great freeways split apart and end at giant department stores and corporate office parks, and three-lane roads clogged with vehicles driven by the parents who send their children to Samuel's school. Children like Laura Potsdam, blonde, lightly freckled, dressed sloppily in logoed tank tops and sweatshorts with various words written across the butt, majoring in business marketing and communication, and who, this very day, showed up to Samuel's introduction to literature course, handed in a plagiarized paper, and promptly asked if she could leave. "If we're having a quiz," she said, "I won't leave, but if we're not having a quiz, I really need to leave." "Is there an emergency?" Samuel said. "No, it's just that I don't want to miss any points. Are we doing anything today worth points?"
"We're discussing the reading. It's information you'll probably want to know."
"But is it worth points?" No, I suppose not. Then, okay, I really have to leave. They were reading Hamlet, and Samuel knew from experience that today would be a struggle. The students would be spent, worn down by all that language. The paper he had assigned was about identifying logical fallacies in Hamlet's thinking, which even Samuel had to admit was sort of a bullshit exercise. They would ask why they had to do this, read this old play. They would ask, when are we ever going to need to know about this in real life? He was not looking forward to this class. What Samuel thinks about in these moments is how he used to be a pretty big deal. When he was 24 years old, a magazine published one of his stories. And not just any magazine, but the magazine. They did a special on young writers, 5 under 25, they called it. The next generation of great American authors. And he was one of them. It was the first thing he ever published. It was the only thing he ever published, as it turned out. There was his picture and his bio and his great literature. He had about 50 calls the next day from big-shot book people. They wanted more work. He didn't have more work. They didn't care. He signed a contract and was paid a lot of money for a book he hadn't even written yet. This was 10 years ago, back before America's current financial bleakness, before the crises in housing and banking left the world economy pretty much shattered. It sometimes occurs to Samuel that his career has followed roughly the same trajectory as global finance. The good times of summer 2001 seem now, in hindsight, like a pleasant and whimsical daydream. Let's go, Axeman writes again. He has stopped humping the cave wall and is now leaping in place. Samuel thinks, 9th grade, tragically pimpled, hyperactivity disorder will probably someday end up in my intro to lit class. What did you think about Hamlet? Samuel had asked his class today after Laura's departure. Groans, scowls. Guy in the back held his hands aloft to show his two big meat-hook thumbs pointing down. It was stupid, he said. Didn't make any sense, said another. It was too long, said another. Way too long. Samuel asked his students questions he hoped would spark any kind of conversation. Do you think the ghost is real, or do you think Hamlet is hallucinating? Why do you think Gertrude remarried so quickly? Do you think Claudius is a villain, or is Hamlet just bitter? And so on. Nothing. No reaction. They stared blankly into their laps or at their computers. They always stare at their computers. Samuel has no power over the computers, cannot turn them off. Every classroom is equipped with computers at every single seat, something the school brags about in all the marketing materials sent to parents. Wired campus, preparing students for the 21st century. But it seems to Samuel that all the school is preparing them for is to sit quietly and fake that they're working. To feign the appearance of concentration when in fact they're checking sports scores or email or watching videos or spacing out. And come to think of it, maybe this is the most important lesson the school could teach them about the American workplace. How to sit calmly at your desk and surf the internet and not go insane. How many of you read the whole play? Samuel said. And of the 25 people in the room, only 4 raised their hands. And they raised their hands slowly, shyly, embarrassed at having completed the assigned task. The rest seemed to reproach him, their looks of contempt, their bodies slumped to announce their huge boredom. It was like they blamed him for their apathy. If only he hadn't assigned something so stupid, they wouldn't have had to not do it. Pulling, says Ponage, who now sprints toward the dragon, giant axe in hand. The rest of the raid group follows, crying wildly in approximate imitation of movies they've seen about medieval wars. Ponage, it should be noted, is an elfscape genius. He is a video game savant. Of the 20 elves here tonight, 6 are being controlled by him. He has a whole village of characters that he can choose from, mixing and matching them depending on the fight. A whole self-sustaining microeconomy between them, playing many of them simultaneously using an incredibly advanced technique called multi-boxing that involves several network computers linked to a central command brain that he controls using program maneuvers on his keyboard and 15-button gaming mouse. Ponage knows everything there is to know about the game. It's like he's internalized the secrets of Elfscape like a tree that eventually becomes one with the fence it grows next to. He annihilates orcs, often delivering the killing blow to his signature phrase, "I just pwned your face, noob!" During phase 1 of the fight, they mostly have to watch out for the dragon's tail. which whips around and slams onto the rock floor. So everyone hacks away at the dragon and avoids its tail for the few minutes it takes to get the dragon down to 60% health, which is when the dragon takes to the air.
Phase two,
says Ponage, in a calm voice made robot-sounding from being transmitted over the internet.
Fire incoming, don't stand in the bad.
Fireballs begin pummeling the raid group, and while many players find it a challenge to avoid the fire while continuing their dragon-fighting responsibilities, Ponage's characters manage this effortlessly, all six of them moving a couple of taps to their left or right so that the fire misses them by a few pixels. Samuel is trying to dodge the fire, but mostly what he's thinking about right now is the pop quiz he gave in class today. After Laura left and after it became clear the class had not done the assigned reading, he got into a punishing mood. He told his students to write a 250-word explication of the first act of Hamlet. They groaned. He hadn't planned on giving a pop quiz, but something about Laura's attitude left him feeling passive-aggressive. This was an introduction to literature course, but she cared less about literature than she did about points. It wasn't the topic of the course that mattered to her. What mattered was the currency. It reminded him of some Wall Street trader who might buy coffee futures one day and mortgage-backed securities the next. The thing that's traded is less important than how it's measured. Laura thought like this, thought only about the bottom line, her grade, the only thing that mattered. Samuel used to mark up their papers with a red pen, even. He used to teach them the difference between lay and lie, or when to use that and when to use which, or how effect is different from effect, how then is different from than, all that stuff. But then one day he was filling up his car at the gas station just outside campus. It's called the Easy Come In and Go, and he looked at that sign and thought, what is the point? Really. Honestly, why would they ever need to know Hamlet? He gave a quiz and ended class 30 minutes early. He was tired. He was standing in front of that disinterested crowd, and he began to feel like Hamlet in the first soliloquy. It's substantial. He wanted to disappear. He wanted his flesh to melt into a dew. This was happening a lot lately. He was feeling smaller than his body, as if his spirit had shrunk, always giving up his armrests on airplanes, always the one to move out of the way on sidewalks. That this feeling coincided with his most recent search for internet photos of Bethany, well, that was too obvious to ignore. His thoughts always turn to her when he's doing something he feels guilty about, which these days is just about all the time, his whole life being sort of barnacled by these layers of impenetrable guilt. Bethany, his greatest love, his greatest screw-up, who's still living in New York City, as far as he knows. A violinist playing all the great venues, recording solo albums, doing world tours. Googling her is like opening this great spigot inside him. He doesn't know why he punishes himself like that. Once every few months, looking at pictures late into the night of Bethany being beautiful in evening gowns, holding her violin in big bunches of roses and surrounded by adoring fans in Paris, Melbourne, Moscow, London. What would she think about this? She would be disappointed, of course. She would think Samuel hasn't grown up at all, still a boy playing video games in the dark, still the kid he was when they first met. Samuel thinks about Bethany the way other people maybe think about God, as in, how is God judging me? Samuel has the same impulse, though he's replaced God with this other great absence, Bethany. And sometimes, if he thinks about this too much, he can fall down a kind of hole, and it's like he's experiencing his life at a one-step remove, as if he's not leading his life, but rather assessing and appraising a life that weirdly, unfortunately, happens to be his. The cursing from his guildmates brings him back to the game. Elves are dying rapidly. The dragon roars from above as the raid unloads all its best long-range violence, arrows and musket balls and throwing knives and electrical lightning-looking things that emerge from the bare hands of the wizards.
"Fire coming at you, Dodger,"
says Ponage, and Samuel realizes he's about to be crushed. He dives out of the way. The fireball lands near him. His health bar empties almost to zero. "Thanks," Samuel writes.
and cheers now as the dragon lands and phase three begins. There remain only a few attackers of the original 20. There's Samuel and Axeman and the raid's healer and four of Pwnage's six characters. They have never reached phase three before. This is the best they've done against this dragon. Phase three is pretty much like phase one, except now the dragon is moving all around and opening up magma veins under the floor and shaking loose huge deadly stalactites from the cave ceiling. Most Elfscape boss fights end this way. They are not so much tests of skill as of pattern memorization and multitasking. Can you avoid the lava splashing up from the floor and dodge the rocks falling from above and watch the dragon's tail so that you're not in the way of it and follow the dragon around its lair to keep hitting it with your dagger using the very specific and complicated 10-move attack that achieves the maximum damage output per second necessary to bring the dragon's health bar to zero before its internal 10-minute timer goes off and it does something called enrages when it goes all crazy and kills everyone in the room? In the throes of it, Samuel usually finds this exhilarating. But immediately after, even if they win the fight, he always feels this crashing disappointment. Because all the treasure they've won is fake treasure, just digital data, and all the weapons and armor they've looted will help them only so long, because as soon as people start beating this dragon, the developers will introduce some new creature, who's even more difficult to kill, and who's guarding even better treasure, a cycle that endlessly repeats. There is no way to ever really win. There is no end in sight, and sometimes the pointlessness of the game seems to reveal itself all at once, such as right now, as he watches the healer try to keep Pwnage alive and the dragon's health bar is slowly creeping towards zero, and Pwnage is yelling, "Go, go, go, go!" And they are right on the verge of an epic win. Even now, Samuel thinks the only things really happening here are a few lonely people tapping keyboards in the dark, sending electrical signals to a Chicagoland computer server, which sends them back little puffs of data. Everything else, the dragon and its lair and the coursing magma and the elves and their swords and their magic, is all window dressing. All a facade. Why am I here? He wonders. Even as he is crushed by the dragon's tail and Axeman is impaled by a falling stalactite and the healer burns to ash in a lava crevice. And so the only elf remaining is Pwnage, and the only way they're going to win is if Pwnage can stay alive. And the guild cheers through their headsets and the dragon's health ticks down to 4%, 3%, 2%. Samuel wonders, even now, so close to victory. What is the point? What am I doing? What would Bethany think? 3. The dance Pwnage does in his living room looks like a conglomeration of things football players do in end zones after touchdowns. He is fond of this one maneuver where he moves his fists in a wheel in front of him. Churning the butter is what he thinks this is called. "Pwnage rules!" somebody shouts. The elves would be giving him a standing ovation if they weren't all corpses. Their approval roars out of the speakers of his home theater array. All six of his computer screens now show different angles of a dead dragon. He churns the butter. He does that fist pump thing that looks like he's starting a lawnmower. Also that obscene dance where it's like he's spanking something directly in front of him, presumably ass. The elves' ghosts make their way back to their bodies and one by one his friends pop up from the cave floor, resurrected in that special video game way where you die but you never really die. Pwnage collects the loot at the far end of the cave and hands it out to his guildies. Swords and axes and plate armor and magic rings. It makes him feel benevolent and big-hearted like a man on Christmas Day dressed as Santa. Then the others begin logging off and he says goodbye individually to each of his guildies and congratulates them on their excellent performances and tries to convince them to stay online longer. And they complain that it's too late at night and they have to work in the morning, and so he agrees, finally, that it's time to go to sleep. And he logs out and shuts down all his computers and slips into bed and closes his eyes. And that's when his mind starts him with the sparkles, those hallucinatory blips of elves and orcs and dragons that cascade unstoppably through his head as he tries to rest after another of his Elfscape benders. He hadn't intended to play the game today. He certainly hadn't intended to play as long as he did. Today was supposed to be the first day of his new diet. Today was the day he had vowed to start eating better. Fruits and vegetables and lean proteins and no trans fats.
and nothing processed and reasonable portions and carefully balanced meals of huge nutritional abundance beginning today. And he launched his brand new eating better lifestyle that very morning by cracking open a Brazil nut and chewing it and swallowing it because Brazil nuts were one of the top five foods you're not eating enough of, according to the diet book he bought in preparation for today, along with the diet book's sequel books and the diet's associated meal plans and mobile device apps, all of which advocated a cuisine made up largely of animal proteins and nuts, basically hunter-gatherer. And he thought about all the heart-healthy good fats and antioxidants and meta-nutrients inside the Brazil nut pouring through his own body, doing helpful things like zapping free radicals and lowering his cholesterol, and hopefully strengthening his energy levels because there was so much to do. The kitchen urgently needed renovation. The countertop laminate was cracking and curling at the edges, and the dishwasher stopped working last spring, and the garbage disposal died maybe a year ago, and three of the four burners on the stove were useless, and the refrigerator had lately gone insane. The fridge side shutting down unpredictably and spoiling hot dogs and lunch meats and souring milk, while the freezer side occasionally went hyperactive and locked all his TV dinners in permafrost. Also, the kitchen cabinets needed to be cleared of various plastic collections of Tupperware gone yellow with age, and the forgotten bags of dried fruit or nuts or potato chips, and the many small cylindrical containers of herbs and spices arranged in geological layers formed by his previous attempts to start new diets, each attempt requiring the purchase of whole new sets of herbs and spices because in the time elapsed since the last serious attempt, the old herbs and spices fused within their jars into single, unusable, dehydrated chunks. And he knew he should open up all the cabinets and throw everything away and make sure there were no colonies of bacteria or bugs living in the farthest, darkest back corners, but he didn't really want to open the cabinets and check for bugs because he was afraid of what he might find, namely bugs. Because then he'd have to put up plastic and fumigate and clear space elsewhere to create a kind of staging area in which to pile the necessary parts, the new cabinetry and planks for the hardwood flooring and the new appliances and the various hammers, saws, boxes of nails, screws, PVC pipes, and other shit necessary for drastic kitchen reconstruction. Though looking around the house, he understood how difficult this was going to be. The living room, for example, had to be a no-construction debris zone in case some evening in the future he found himself entertaining unexpected guests, meaning Lisa, who would not find heaps of tools inviting or romantic. Same with the bedroom, also a bad staging area choice for exactly the same reason, though admittedly it had been quite a while since Lisa had come over, mostly because she insisted they maintain their distance during this new phase of their relationship. An edict that did not stop her from asking for rides to work and to various mini-malls to complete various errands, and just because Lisa had divorced him didn't mean he would let her hang high and dry without a driver's license and a car. And while he knew most guys would do exactly that, he was just raised differently. So the only viable staging area for kitchen detritus would be the spare bedroom. Unfortunately, also impossible because the bedroom was already overflowing with things the throwing away of which was unthinkable. The boxes of high school awards, badges, trophies, medals, achievement certificates, and somewhere in there that black leather journal that contained the first several pages of a novel he promised himself he'd get around to writing very soon. And so he had to go through those boxes and catalog their contents before he could create the proper staging area necessary for the kitchen renovation that was required if he was going to start his brand new diet. Plus, there was the matter of budget, as in how to afford a totally new healthy diet plan when already he was falling into profound debt paying for his many accounts to World of Elfscape and his new smartphone. And yes, from an outside perspective, he could see how the purchase of a $400 smartphone and concomitant unlimited text and data plan might have seemed exorbitant for someone whose livelihood did not depend on the accessibility of electronic communication. And in fact, the overwhelming majority of text messages sent to his smartphone after its purchase were from the maker of the smartphone itself, asking him whether he was satisfied with his purchase and offering him insurance plans and encouraging him to try the company's other software and hardware products, with the few other text messages coming from Lisa,
saying that she was unexpectedly needed at the Lancome counter, or was leaving the Lancome counter early, or was staying late at the Lancome counter, or didn't need a ride because she'd been invited out by someone at work. And these were the texts that made him shudder with jealousy at their infuriating ambiguity. And he curled up on the couch and chewed his brittle fingernails and wondered at the boundaries of Lisa's fidelity. And while, of course, he could no longer expect hegemonic marital monogamy, while he could acknowledge the divorce created a certain finality to their relationship, he also knew that she did not leave him for another man, and he was still a major fact in her life, and so part of him thought that if he was useful enough to Lisa, and helpful enough, and present enough that she would never actually leave him, hence the need for the smartphone. Also, the essential diet and exercise-related apps available on the phone were indispensable in any new Eating Right program. Apps where he could record each day's food and drink intake and receive an analysis of how he was doing both calorically and nutritionally. For example, he recorded what he ate in a normal day to set a kind of baseline by which his future excellent Eating Right diet could be accurately compared, and found that his 3 espressos for breakfast, with sugar, registered at 100 calories, his 6 shot latte and brownie for lunch was another 400 calories, leaving him 1,500 calories shy of his 2,000 calorie daily ceiling, meaning that for dinner, he likely had room for 2 and maybe even 3 frozen packages of Ocean Bonanza salmon fajitas, each kit containing precisely cut French fry looking fajita vegetables and a packet of salty red stuff called Southwestern spices, to which he usually added another tablespoon or so of salt, the smartphone diet app registering this as 0 calories, which he considered a huge flavor victory. And he ate these frozen salmon meals rather quickly and intensely while trying to ignore that the microwave cooked things so unevenly the green peppers could literally burn his tongue, while the insides of some of the larger salmon lumps were still so cold they crumbled apart with the texture of something like damp tree bark, all of which made for an incredibly unpleasant mouthfeel but did not prevent him from stuffing his freezer full of salmon fajita kits, not only because the boxes said they were surprisingly low fat, but also because the 7-Eleven was having a consistent and amazing 10 for $5 clearance deal on them, limit 10. Anyway, the smartphone app analyzed the nutrients and metanutrients he consumed and compared them to FDA-recommended dosages of all the important vitamins, acids, fats, etc., and displayed the results in a graph that should have been a soothing green if he were doing it all correctly, but was actually a panic button red due to his alarming lack of really anything necessary for the maintenance of basic organ health. And yes, he had to admit that lately his eyeballs and the ends of his hair had acquired a disconcerting yellowish hue, and his fingernails had become thinner and more brittle and had a tendency, when chewed, to suddenly split right down the middle almost all the way to the base. And recently his nails and hair had stopped growing completely and now seemed to recede in places or even curl back on themselves. And also he developed a more or less permanent rash on his arm at the place a wristwatch would go. So while he was typically far under his 2,000 calorie daily maximum, he understood that the calories he needed to consume in order to eat better were totally different kinds of calories, namely the organic, fresh, whole food kind that were prohibitively expensive given the monthly credit card payments he was making on his smartphone and its associated text and data plans. And he grasped the paradox of this, that it was somewhat of an ironic bind that paying for the device that showed him how to eat right prevented him from having the money to actually be able to eat right. And yes, he was putting all this on his credit card, the debt on which was painfully growing and his ability to pay it off fading away from him like a sort of continental drift. Ditto his mortgage payments, which also kept going up because a realtor had convinced him years ago before the town and the nation's real estate market in general went to total shit to refinance his house using some negative amortization instrument. This was a huge financial windfall at the time and allowed the purchase of an HD television and various elaborate video game consoles and an expensive at-home computer workstation,
but now was a huge financial drain as the mortgage payments kept jumping shockingly higher, while his home's value had, at last check, crashed and flatlined at such a confoundingly low number it was as if the house had suffered a catastrophic interior meth lab explosion. And this made him feel stressed. This, coupled with all the other financial and budgetary problems, so stressed out that his heart was doing funny things, a kind of jumpy twitchy thing that felt like someone mechanically palpating his thoracic cavity from the inside. And like Lisa said,
you don't have anything if you don't have your health.
Which was how he justified his investment in things that helped reduce the stress, namely high-end electronics and video games. Which was where he turned today. Before completing the chores required of his new diet, he decided he would finish his other chores, the ones waiting for him in Elfscape, the 20 tasks he completed every day that earned him seriously cool game rewards, like flying rideable griffins and axes of an unlikely size and neat-looking formal jackets and trousers that made his avatar look dapper when he walked around in them. These quests, which usually involved slaying some minor enemy or delivering a message across treacherous terrain or locating some lost important doodad, needed to be completed every day without fail for up to 40 days in a row to unlock the rewards in the fastest time mathematically possible. Which itself was kind of reward because whenever he was successful at it, these fireworks went off and there was this blast of trumpets, and he got his name on the public chart of Elfscape's most epic players, and everyone on his contact list sent him notes of congratulations and praise. It was like the game equivalent of being the groom at a wedding, and since Pwnage played with not just one character, but enough characters to field a whole softball team, it meant that as soon as he finished the 20 daily quests on his main character, he then repeated them for his alternate characters as well, so that the number of daily quests completions required of him jumped to somewhere around 200 or more, depending on how many alts he was interested in leveling. This meant the whole daily quest process took about 5 hours total, and while he knew that playing a video game for 5 hours straight represented the outside maximum tolerance most people had for playing video games, for him, these 5 hours were simply the prerequisite to actually playing the game, a kind of warm-up for the real play session, something he needed to get out of the way before the fun could really begin. So by the time he finished the daily quest grind today, it was dark outside, and his mind felt so fuzzy and remote and sort of constipationally plugged up after 5 hours of rote tasks that he did not have the focus or drive or energy for difficult higher-order engagements, like shopping or cooking or a complicated kitchen renovation. So he stayed at his computer and recharged with a six-shot latte and a frozen burrito and kept on playing. He played for so long that now, as he tries to sleep, he finds the sparkles especially amped up and there's no way sleep is going to come anytime soon. And so the only thing Pwnage can really do is get out of bed and fire up the computers once more and check the West Coast servers and go on another raid. Then he joins the Australian servers hours later and attacks the dragon again. Then by 4 a.m. the hardcore Japanese players come online, which is always a windfall, and he teams up with these guys and kills the dragon a couple more times, until killing the dragon no longer feels triumphant, but rather routine and ordinary, and maybe a little tedious. And around the time that India appears, the sparkles have morphed into more of a fleeting mushy luminescence, and he abandons the game and he feels all hazy, like his forehead is physically 3 feet away from his face, and he decides he needs some decompression time before going to sleep, so he pops in one of the DVDs he's seen a million times. The thinking here is that he can let it play and zone out a bit, since he knows the film so well, not having to do any hard work brain-wise. One of his collection of apocalyptic disaster movies where the Earth is destroyed in any number of ways, meteors, aliens, off-the-charts interior magma activity, and his mind begins to glaze over within the first 15 minutes, at the point the protagonist figures out the secret the government's been keeping all this time, and now knows there's some seriously heavy shit about to go down. Pwnage zones out and reflects on his day,
remembers vaguely his eager and intense desire that very afternoon to start eating better, and maybe because he feels guilty that he did not, in fact, find it the right day to start eating better, he cracks open another Brazil nut, figuring maybe it's best to kind of ease into these things, that the Brazil nut is a bridge between his current life and the eating better life that is ahead of him, and he spaces out and stares at the television with an empty, fish-like quality in his eyes, and swallows the thick Brazil nut bolus and watches as the earth is destroyed, and he sort of happily imagines a rock the size of California falling into the earth, and in a skeleton melting flash wiping out everything, killing everyone, annihilating it all, and he rises from the couch, and it's almost dawn, and he wonders where the night went. And he stumbles into his bedroom and sees himself in the mirror, his white-yellow hair, his eyeballs red with fatigue and dehydration, and he gets into bed and he doesn't so much fall asleep as he plummets into a sudden all-over concussive darkness. And the thing he tries to hold in his mind in this near-comatose state is the memory of himself dancing. He wants to remember what that felt like, a moment of transcendent joy. He had defeated the dragon for the first time. His Chicago friends all cheered. But now it won't come to him, the feeling that made him dance so exuberantly. Ponage tries to imagine himself doing it, but it feels detached. It has the quality of something he saw on television long ago. The way he feels now, it couldn't have been him churning the butter, starting the lawnmower, spanking that ass. Tomorrow, he vows. Tomorrow will be the first day of the new diet. The real official first day. And maybe today was actually a warm-up, or dry run, or head start for the actual first day of the new diet, which would be very soon. One of these days, very soon.